Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news, as well as local guests for homegrown perspectives and connections to local resources. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily, in a healthy community, on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Here we are, episode number 75. It's Friday, August 14th. I am recording this show from the Donald Trump Memorial Studio. Welcome to the People's School of Health in the University of Life. You're listening to locally produced non-commercial content from WAKT 106.1 FM Toledo. Okay, let's get right to it with a local update on the status of our very own COVID-19 epidemic. Good news, newly identified infections in Lucas County continue a steady drop. The 7-day average of new COVID-19 infections has dropped by over 20% over the last week. Still, the level of reported infections is about 7 times higher than the low we had in June. Still, Lucas County, relative to Ohio's other 6 metropolitan areas, is the worst off in Ohio. Active cases in Lucas County nursing homes have held steady, perhaps the best we could expect. Looks like we have avoided skyrocketing cases from the recent surge, which now seems to be on a substantial downward trend. Okay, well, moving to Ohio news, this from the Ohio Capital Journal. 7 months into pandemic, COVID-19 testing still falling short in Ohio. For most Ohioans, testing scarcity, antigen, antibody, and diagnostic, the PCR test, has been and continues to be the norm as the new coronavirus continues its march through Ohio and the United States. In July, about 22,000 Ohioans were PCR tested daily. That's the typical diagnostic test on average. Projections the state submitted to the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services in July estimate that number will only reach 24,000 in August. DeWine, fresh off a scare brought on by the faster, less accurate antigen test used by the White House before Trump's visit, said the Ohio Department of Health's testing goals for August are shamefully low. When they told me what they were reporting, I said, "That's not acceptable," DeWine stated. I said, "You can send that in, but that's not what our goal is. Those numbers are simply not acceptable." Yeah, continuing with his steady false positivity. Yeah, just put it in there, but don't actually do anything about it. Okay. He said, "I said you can send that in, but that's not what the goal is. Those numbers are simply not acceptable." Projections from the Harvard Global Health Institute, based on test positivity, hospitalization rates, and other data, estimate Ohio is testing about 63% of the people the researchers estimate is necessary to mitigate the spread of the virus. With schools set to reopen and flu season on the horizon, it's believed that there simply are not tests to meet demand brought on by a national surge in COVID-19 cases. Ohio's test positivity rate, the proportion of a batch of tests that come back positive, is 5.3% as of last Friday, measured by a 7-day moving average. The World Health Organization advises governments if the figure is greater than 5%, they do not have outbreaks under control. Increased testing demand brought on by a July surge slowed down test turnaround times, complicating contact tracing efforts. Quest Diagnostics, a major private testing lab, said last week its average turnaround time is 5 days, 1 day for priority patients. As of August 10th, LabCorp, another private lab, is down to 1 to 3 tests from specimen pickup. Specimens are transported to a lab for testing. Dr. Dustin Calhoun, Medical Director of Emergency Management for University of Cincinnati Health, said turnaround time is improving, but the supply chain is fragile. He said in Southwest Ohio, as cases surged, one lab processing machine broke while another was subverted to validate results of a new lab machine. All this added to the delay between test and result. The slow process causes problems of its own. It's hard to break the chains of transmission if an asymptomatic infected person mingles in the community for days before getting a positive result back from the lab. Long turnaround times like that certainly hinder a lot of the benefits of the test, Calhoun said. Different ideas are in the works. Ohio partnered with five other states in an interstate compact for 3 million antigen tests. DeWine said no contract has been signed. Antigen tests produce results much faster than diagnostic tests, but are more prone to false positives, as DeWine experienced personally. When we deploy an antigen test, we've got to think long and hard about how we're going to deploy it, he said. Okay, well, let's move along with the whole issue of school reopenings, which is the next horizon of this pandemic. This from the Columbus Dispatch. Ohio back-to-school plans amid COVID vary widely between metro, rural areas. More than 500,000 Ohio public school students are set to return to the classroom this fall, despite the continuing coronavirus pandemic. That represents 38% of public school students and about 325 districts that are planning for in-person classes, Governor Mike DeWine said. Around 398,000 students, or 26% from 55 districts, will have classes fully online, while close to 380,000 students, 25% in 154 districts, will be operating under a hybrid model featuring both in-person and online classes, the governor said. I think our schools are doing a very good job at getting ready. They've been working very, very hard, DeWine said. Unfortunately, getting an A for effort does not necessarily result in outcomes. Okay, the governor's office does not have information yet on the plans of 78 school districts, DeWine said. The figures released Tuesday also don't include information on 167,000 students in chartered private schools and 103,000 in community schools. Moving to the collegiate level, this from the Columbus Dispatch, Ohio State makes COVID testing mandatory for all students living on campus. The Ohio State's new president has announced that the university intends to implement stricter COVID-19 safety measures this fall, including regular mandatory testing of all students living on campus and a mask requirement outdoors. Incoming President Krista M. Johnson announced the changes in her first campus-wide communication Tuesday evening. On the cusp of a fall semester like no other, she wrote. In addition to the increased testing of all students living on campus, changes include reducing maximum class size from 100 to 50, mandatory mask wearing outdoors on campus, offering opportunities for faculty and staff to be tested on a weekly basis, limiting in-person events and gatherings to fewer than 10 people, and recruiting more students and staff to assist with contact tracing. The changes came just hours before Ohio State students were to begin moving in Wednesday morning, and 2 weeks before Johnson will officially take over as president on August 24th. Classes are scheduled to begin the next day, August 25th. Johnson warned that in order for the university to remain open this fall, we have to drive the COVID-19 positivity rate well below the current Franklin County rate of 5.5%. In order not to fill up the residence hall spaces and hospital beds available for quarantine, isolation, and treatment. If the positivity rate does not decrease, the university will shut down the remaining in-person aspects of the semester. If we cannot reduce the rate of infection and hospitalizations, we will return to remote instruction and have to close residence halls, Johnson said. Avoiding this means we will have to shoulder a measure of the burden and adhere to stricter health and safety guidelines. Johnson's announcement of testing changes comes less than 2 weeks after the university had unveiled its original COVID-19 testing program. Ohio State previously planned to randomly test a sample of 6,500 undergraduate students throughout the semester, in addition to students, faculty, or staff who experienced COVID-19 symptoms. Under the expanded testing program, testing participation is mandatory for all students living on campus or in university-managed housing. Students can choose to opt out of the program, but this may result in moving to fully online courses, and those students may not be able to live in university housing, Johnson said. Ohio State officials have already said students will be required to wear face masks in indoor settings, participate in daily health checks, complete health and safety training online, and sign a pledge before returning to campus. Johnson's announcement Tuesday evening took the university's mask requirement a step further, requiring face coverings to be worn outdoors at all times. Previously, the university had said masks would be required outdoors where individuals could not maintain 6 feet of physical distance. I think for practical considerations, that's actually a pretty wise thing to do. Can you imagine putting your mask on and off all the time while you're walking through a crowded campus? It's probably better just to have a policy when you're walking around campus to have a mask on. Okay, next up, let's look at how another state's handling things. This from the Boston Globe. When should schools use only remote learning? Massachusetts issued new metrics to help districts decide using COVID-19 infection rates. Massachusetts education officials have issued new guidelines that could dramatically limit the use of remote learning, potentially throwing an 11th hour wrench into school reopening plans days before they are due, according to information obtained by the Globe. The vast majority of communities statewide are in the white or green zones, indicating COVID-19 infection rates are low or non-existent. The new metrics recommend that these districts open full-time and only shift to a mix of in-person and remote learning in extenuating circumstances. The state does not advise these districts to offer only remote instruction for all students. Thomas Scott, executive director of the Massachusetts Association of School Superintendents, welcomed the new guidance from the state but wished it had come sooner. It's great to have this, but it would have been better to have this 3 weeks ago when critical decisions were being made, he said. Let's face it, every superintendent has been put in a wedge between parents' desire and teacher demands and without any clear guidance or metric. Superintendents have been left on their lonesome to make recommendations. COVID-19 infection rates under the color-coded map in Massachusetts and the new school reopening metrics are based on cases recorded over a two-week period. The new metric breaks down this way. Red will designate communities with more than 8 COVID cases per 100,000 residents. Districts should use remote learning. Yellow will designate communities that have more than 4 and up to 8 COVID-19 cases per 100,000 residents. Districts should use a mix of in-person and remote learning. They should also tap remote-only instruction in extenuating circumstances. Green will designate communities that have 4 or fewer COVID-19 cases per 100,000 residents. Districts should open full-time or use a hybrid of extenuating circumstances. Unshaded will designate communities with small populations and fewer than 5 total cases within the last 14 days. Districts should open full-time or use a hybrid in extenuating circumstances. I should point out that last week I reported on the Lucas County Regional Health Board recommending that all of Lucas County schools do only remote learning until October 1st. That's actually consistent with this Massachusetts guidance, where they say that any community that has more than 8 COVID-19 cases per 100,000 should use remote learning. We are well above that now, even though our caseloads have come down. Hopefully in the next few weeks or the next month or so, by October 1st, we can get it down and do some hybrid models and get some in-person learning. Okay, well, there are plenty of places and plenty of entire states that are rushing forward with school opening, even though they're in epidemic situations far worse than what we are here in Lucas County and Ohio. Of course, one of those, if you want to do it big, go to Texas. This from the Texas Tribune. Coronavirus testing in Texas plummets as schools prepare to reopen. The number of Texans being tested for the coronavirus has fallen sharply in recent weeks, a trend that has worried public health experts as officials consider sending children back to school while thousands more Texans are infected each day. In the week ending August 8th, an average of 36,000 coronavirus tests were administered in Texas each day, a drop of about 42% from 2 weeks earlier. At the same time, the percentage of tests yielding positive results has climbed up to 20% on average. 2 weeks earlier, the average positivity rate was around 14%. On Saturday, the state set a record for its positivity rate, with more than half of the day's roughly 14,000 viral tests indicating infection. Over 50%. That's actually the highest I've ever heard. That's frightening. Taken together, the low number of tests and the large percentage of positive results suggest inadequacies in the state public health surveillance effort at a time when school reopenings are certain to increase viral spread, health experts said. Opening the schools is a really complicated problem, and the best thing we can do to get is to get the number of cases down so kids can go back to school safely, said Catherine Triosi, an infectious disease epidemiologist at University of Texas Health School of Public Health in Houston. There are so many reasons why kids need to be in school, particularly younger kids, but we're finding out more and more they can get infected, and the concern is them bringing it home and spreading in the community and spreading to teachers. I think the worst thing would be for schools to open, then close, she said. That really makes it hard on parents, that unpredictability, and there's a lot of costs associated with opening the schools safely. The number of tests performed in Texas has never been great, said Vivian Ho, a health economist at Rice University and Baylor College of Medicine, but it's extremely troubling that the numbers have dipped since last month. It's troubling because we can guess at some of the reasons, but we're not sure, she said. She suggested that some people may have been discouraged by long wait times for test results, or less concerned about the virus's toll in Texas after a frightening peak in July began to flatten out, I would add, to merely just terrifying. A declining number of tests is a particularly thorny issue for schools, Ho said. No public school has the resources to do testing under the current circumstances. There are huge class sizes and crowded hallways, she said. In San Antonio, health officials last week said a return to school would lead to new viral transmission, and a growing body of evidence shows racial disparities in children's susceptibility to severe illness from the virus. We know that children are less likely to be sick, but not immune, said Dr. Junda Wu, medical director for San Antonio's Metropolitan Health District. She said that there were about 80 children with coronavirus in local hospitals on Wednesday. Hispanic children were about 8 times as likely as white children to be hospitalized, while black children were 5 times as likely, researchers found. In Texas, about 53% of public school students are Hispanic, and about 13% are black. Outbreaks will happen in schools, Wu said. She likened schools to other group settings that have seen significant clusters of infection, such as nursing homes and daycares. It's going to seep in from the community as a whole. Governor Greg Abbott said on July 31st that local health officials could not issue blanket orders that preemptively block schools in their jurisdictions from opening their classrooms for in-person instruction. That statement, which followed similar guidance from Attorney General Ken Paxton, came after about 18 local health authorities had issued such orders. The move frustrated some superintendents, who said they were hamstrung in their ability to respond to the pandemic. Abbott said that local health officials could shut down schools that have COVID-19 outbreaks after they reopen. Okay, well, when you look about how bad we have it in some places in this country, may offer some perverse relief to look elsewhere in the world where things are even worse. This from the World Health Organization. 2 in 5 schools around the world lacked basic hand washing facilities prior to COVID-19 pandemic, says UNICEF. As schools worldwide struggle with reopening, the latest data from UNICEF Joint Monitoring Program revealed that 43% of schools around the world lacked access to basic hand washing with soap and water in 2019, a key condition for schools to be able to operate safely in the midst of the COVID-19 epidemic. According to the report, around 818 million children lack basic hand washing facilities at their schools, which puts them at increased risk of COVID-19 and other transmittable diseases. More than one-third of these children, 295 million, are from sub-Saharan Africa. In the least developed countries, 7 out of 10 schools lack basic hand washing facilities, and half of schools lack basic sanitation and water services. Okay, well, back to the U.S., and this from the Galactically Stupid Desk from Gizmodo. Florida sheriff bans masks as state COVID-19 death toll breaks new daily record. Good old Florida. Billy Woods, the sheriff of Central Florida's Marion County, banned masks for all deputies and visitors to the sheriff's office starting Tuesday, according to a new report from the Ocala Star-Banner. A strange decision to make in the middle of a pandemic that's still wildly out of control. Sheriff Woods has instructed staff not to wear masks while on duty and said that any public visitors to the sheriff's office, which currently employs about 900 people, should be told that masks are banned. Anyone who doesn't want to remove their mask will be told to leave, according to a memo written by Woods and obtained by the Ocala Star-Banner. Effective immediately, any individual walking into any one of our lobbies, which includes the main office and all district offices, that is wearing a mask will be asked to remove it, Woods wrote. Masks are a vital public health tool to help slow the spread of coronavirus, according to the CDC. And the sheriff's mask ban come as Florida broke a new record for daily deaths from COVID-19. And continuing with the theme of galactically stupid, this time of a partisan nature, this from the Nashville Tennessean. Despite rise in COVID-19 cases, dozens of Republican lawmakers continue to refuse to wear masks during special session. With the ongoing COVID-19 pandemic, members of the public interested in seeing the legislator in person during this week's special session and legislative staff are required to wear masks when they enter lawmakers' offices building in Nashville. But the mask requirement continues to be flouted by many lawmakers. When the legislature returned to Nashville on Monday, dozens of House Republicans walked around the Cordell Hull office building in the state capitol while not wearing masks. On Monday, when the House Republican caucus gathered ahead of an afternoon floor session, the Tennessean observed at least 32 members who entered the meeting without a mask. 23 Republicans walked in the caucus meeting, which was closed to the press, wearing a mask. So that's the majority of them not wearing a mask. The divide on masks at the legislature is largely along party lines. By and large, Democrats have been wearing masks during a special session. Noticing the lack of masks, two House lawmakers pleaded with their colleagues during Tuesday's floor session to change their ways. House Majority Leader William Lamberth, Republican from Portland, cited Nashville's rise in COVID-19 cases and the city's mask mandate as the reason some members are wearing them. "This is still up to each member," he said. "They answer to their constituents. Such an option is not afforded to the public, legislative, or members of the press, all of whom are required to wear masks while inside the Cordell Hull building." Well, apparently, you can make the laws, but you don't have to follow them.
And now a message from our lack of sponsors. Do you, your friends and loved ones, your city, state, your entire nation, suffer from an unprecedented crisis? Then your body politic may be infected with TLTL 2020 virus, also known as the TL20 squared virus. This too little too late 2020 virus has many vague and contradicting symptoms, but it is known to be exacerbated by election years. Do you suffer from exponential anxiety, worldwide depression, and recurring hallucinations of unimpeachable leadership? Don't worry, as the 2020 campaign season heats up, this will all go away. We don't call it a novelty virus for nothing. Hey people, don't look down. Things are looking up. Body bag futures are looking fantastic. This promises to be the best pandemic ever. Incredible things will happen as you save the world by doing nothing but watching TV. But remember, only get your Nothing Burgers from the drive-thru window. Please note, Nothing Burgers will now be referred to as Patriot Burgers. Doing too little has never been easier. Hey, what's the worst? That could happen. This message is brought to you by Cassandra Reproductions, seer of unbelievable futures, and maker of Pickled Posterity, coming too little, too late, to a shuttered store near you. You may now return to your regular programming.
Okay, folks. Well, despite the surge in cases peaking and going down in some places, although it looks like it's leveled off nationally, we are far from done with this pandemic. And here in the U.S., we have a doozy of an epidemic. This from ABC News. 26 states will soon face shortage of ICU doctors. Nurses, respiratory therapists, pharmacists will come up short too, says a study. They built field hospitals, transformed operating rooms into ICUs, and ingeniously crafted their own ventilators and masks. And now they're strapped for the people who make up a critical care workforce. Researchers at George Washington University Institute School of Public Health found that the majority of states are now at risk for shortages in healthcare workers needed to treat critically ill patients, including those with COVID-19. This week's report shows alarming projected shortages over last week in doctors, nurses, respiratory therapists, and pharmacists. The most recent update finds that 26 states will soon face shortages in ICU doctors, up from only 5 last week. 10 states are at risk of running low on critical care nurses. 7 face shortages in doctors trained to work in hospitals. 9 states will not have enough respiratory therapists, up from 0 last week. six states will face shortages in pharmacists. This stark prediction brings back recent memories of workforce shortages in New York City when healthcare workers from all over the country answered the call to action. These highly trained doctors, nurses, respiratory therapists, and pharmacists all work together to provide potentially life-saving care to COVID-19 and other seriously ill patients, said Patricia Pittman, PhD, director of the Fitzhugh-Mullen Institute of Health Workforce Equity at the Milken Institute. At a time when COVID-19 continues to surge in the United States, she added, our current analysis shows that most states are at a risk of running low on these critical healthcare workers. And the good news just keeps coming. This from Stat News. Winter is coming. Why America's window of opportunity to beat back COVID-19 is closing. The good news? The United States has a window of opportunity to beat back COVID-19 before things get much, much worse. The bad news? That window is rapidly closing, and the country seems unwilling or unable to seize the moment. Winter is coming. Winter means cold and flu season, which is all but sure to complicate the task of figuring out who is sick with COVID-19 and who is suffering from a less threatening respiratory tract infection. It also means that cherished outdoor freedoms that link us to pre-COVID life, pop-up restaurant patios, picnics in parks, trips to the beach, will soon be out of reach, at least in northern parts of the country. Unless Americans use the dwindling weeks between now and the onset of indoor weather to tamp down transmission in the country, this winter could be Dickensianly bleak, public health experts warn. Now, there is the word for the week. I think November, December, January, February are going to be tough months in this country without a vaccine, said Michael Osterholm, director of the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy at the University of Minnesota. Human coronaviruses, the distant cold-causing cousins of the virus that causes COVID-19, circulate year-round. Now is typically the low season for transmission, but in this summer of America's failed COVID-19 response, the SARS-CoV-2 virus is widespread across the country, and the pandemic-weary Americans seem more interested in resuming pre-COVID lifestyles than in suppressing the virus to the point where schools can be reopened and stay open, and restaurants, movie theaters, and gyms can function with some restrictions. We should be aiming for no transmission before we open the schools and we put kids in harm's way, kids and teachers and their caregivers. And so if it means no gym, no movie theater, so be it, said Carolyn Buckey, Associate Director of the Center for Communicable Disease Dynamics at Harvard School of Public Health. We seem to be choosing leisure activities now over children's safety in a month's time, and I cannot understand that trade-off. While many countries managed to suppress the spread of SARS-CoV-2, the United States has failed miserably. Countries in Europe and Asia are worrying about a second wave. Here, the first wave rages on, engulfing rural as well as urban parts of the country. Though there's been a slight decline of cases in the past couple of weeks, more than 50,000 Americans a day are being diagnosed with COVID-19, and those are just the confirmed cases. To put that in perspective, at this rate, the U.S. is racking up more cases in a week than Britain has accumulated since the start of the pandemic. Public health officials had hoped transmission of the virus would abate with the warm temperatures of summer and the tendency, heightened this year, of people to take their recreational activities outdoors. Experts do believe people are less likely to transmit the virus outside, especially if they are wearing face coverings and keeping a safe distance apart. But in some places, people have been throwing COVID cautions to the wind, flouting public health orders in the process. Christine Ayersman, Director of the Infectious Disease Epidemiology Prevention and Control for the Minnesota Department of Health, points to a large three-day rodeo that was held recently in her state. Organizers knew they were supposed to limit the number of attendees to 250, but refused. Thousands attended. In Sturgis, South Dakota, an estimated 250,000 motorcyclists were expected to descend on the city this past weekend for an annual rally that spans 10 days. Even on smaller scales, public health authorities know some people are letting down their guard. Others have never embraced the need to try to prevent the spread of the virus. Erisman's father was recently invited to visit some friends. He went, she said, but wore his mask, elbow bumping instead of shaking preferred hands. And the people kind of acted like, oh, you drank that Kool-Aid, rather than, we all need to be doing this. Ayersman and others in public health are flummoxed by the phenomenon of people refusing to acknowledge the risk the virus poses. Just this idea of, I just don't want to believe it, so therefore it's not going to be true. Honestly, I've not really dealt with that as it relates to disease before, she said. Bucky, the Harvard expert, wonders if the magical thinking that seems to have infected swaths of the country is due to the fact that many of the people have died were elderly. For many Americans, she said, the disease has not yet touched their lives, but the movement restrictions and other response measures have. I think if children were dying, this would be a different situation, quite honestly, she said. Epidemiologist Michael Minna despairs that an important chance to wrestle the virus under control is being lost as Americans ignore the realities of the pandemic in favor of trying to resume pre-COVID life. We just continue to squander every bit of opportunity we get with this epidemic to get it under control, said Minna, an associate professor at Harvard's School of Public Health and associate medical director of clinical microbiology at Boston's Brigham and Women's Hospital. The best time to squash a pandemic is when the environmental characteristics slow transmission. It's your one opportunity in the year, really, to leverage that extra assistance and get transmission under control, he said, his frustration audible. Driving back transmission would require people to continue to make sacrifices, to accept the fact that life post-COVID cannot proceed as normal, not while so many people remain vulnerable to the virus. Instead, people are giddily throwing off the shackles of coronavirus suppression efforts, seemingly convinced that a few weeks of sacrifice during the spring was a one-time solution. Osterholm has for months warned that people are being misled about how long the restrictions on daily life would need to be in place. He now thinks the time has come for another lockdown. What we did before and more, he said. The country has fallen into a dangerous pattern, Osterholm said, where a spike in cases in a location leads to some temporary restraint from people who eventually become alarmed enough to start to take precautions. But as soon as cases start to plateau or decline a little, victory of the virus is declared and people think it's safe to resume normal life. Case in point, here in Lucas County, it feels good to have our cases drop by a quarter each of the last 2 weeks, but we're still about seven times higher than the low we were in June. So the relative level seems to affect our psychology more than a real acute understanding of the actual level, which reflects the actual risk of getting infected. And back to the article. It's like an all-or-nothing phenomenon, right? Said Anthony Fauci, director of the National Institute for Allergy and Infectious Disease. You all lock down and or you get so discouraged with being in lockdown that you decide you're going to be in a crowded bar. You can have indoor parties with no masks. You can do all the things you're going to do to get into trouble. Osterholm said with the K-12 school year resuming in some parts of the country or set to start along with universities, in a few weeks transmission will take off and cases will start to climb again. He predicted the next peaks will exceed by far the peak we have just experienced. Winter is only going to reinforce that. Indoor air, he said. Bucky thinks that if the country doesn't alter the trajectory it's on, more shutdowns are inevitable. I can't see a way that we're going to have restaurants and bars open in the winter, frankly. We'll have resurgence. Everything will get shut down again. Fauci favors a reset of the reopening measures, with a strong messaging component aimed at explaining to people why driving down transmission will pay off later. Young people in particular need to understand that even if they are less likely to die from COVID-19, statistically speaking, transmission among 20-somethings will eventually lead to infections among their parents and grandparents, where the risk of severe infections and fatal outcomes is higher. Young people can also develop long-term health problems as a result of the virus. It's not them alone in a vacuum, Fauci said. They are spreading it to the people who are going to wind up in the hospital. Everyone has to work together to get cases down to more manageable levels if the country hopes to avoid a disastrous winter, he said. I think we can get it under much better control between now and the mid to late fall when we get influenza or we get whatever it is we get in the fall and the winter. I'm not giving up, said Fauci. But without an all-in effort, the cases are not going to come down, he warned. They're not. They're just not.
Hi, I'm Corey the Coronavirus, and I need your help. Once I'm in your body, I can multiply a gazillion times, but I need your help with my travel plans. I am already a worldwide traveler, but I would love to meet up with you at your workplace, out in public, with your friends, anywhere. I'll gladly meet you at your home if you let me. Hey, look, you don't even have to touch me. I understand, because I do give a flying leap. Look, I know I'm nothing special. Most people get over me, but the odds are that someone you know may just be dying to meet me. And those conspiracy-loving friends of yours? Come on, you know you've got some. I'd love to meet them, even if they don't believe my travel plans. In reality, in their presence, I am inspired over and over and over again. Breathe it in, folks. What you believe doesn't really matter to me. I'm just that kind of guy. Well, I've got to get going. I'm really making the rounds these days. Hey, keep in touch. And I really do mean it. But if I don't run into you soon, remember, I'll be back.
This message has been brought to you by Pandemic Travel Bureau. We only go where you have already been, which is why the price you pay to travel with us is never really worth it. Please note, the purchase of any travel plan does not include 6-foot pole.
Okay, well, if there's anything that people can agree on in this epidemic, it's probably that a lot and lots and lots of people have had a lot of stress and aggravation of mental health issues with all that's going on. So now we got some data behind that from the CDC. Mental health, substance use, and suicidal ideation during the COVID-19 pandemic in the United States, June 24th through the 30th, 2020. Elevated levels of adverse mental health conditions, substance use, and suicidal ideation were reported by adults in the United States in June 2020. The prevalence of symptoms of anxiety disorder were approximately 3 times those reported in the second quarter of 2019, 26% versus 8%. And prevalence of depressive disorder was approximately 4 times that reported in the second quarter of 2019, 24% versus 7%. However, given the methodological differences and potential unknown biases in survey design, this analysis might not be directly comparable with data reported on anxiety and depression orders in 2019. Approximately 1/4 of respondents reported symptoms of a traumatic or stress-related disorder related to the pandemic, and approximately 1 in 10 reported that they started or increased substance use because of COVID-19. Suicidal ideation was also elevated. Approximately twice as many respondents reported serious consideration of suicide in the previous 30 days than did adults in the United States in 2018, referring to the previous 12 months, 11% versus 4%. Mental health conditions are disproportionately affecting specific populations, especially young adults, Hispanic persons, Black persons, essential workers, unpaid caregivers for adults, and those receiving treatment for pre-existing psychiatric conditions. Unpaid caregivers for adults, many of whom are currently providing critical aid to persons at increased risk for severe illness from COVID-19, had a higher incidence of adverse mental and behavioral health conditions compared with others. Although unpaid caregivers of children were not evaluated in this study, approximately 39% of unpaid caregivers for adults shared a household with children, compared with only 27% of other respondents. Caregiver workload, especially in multi-generational caregivers, should be considered for future assessment of mental health, given the findings of this report and the hardships potentially faced by caregivers. Okay, next up on another substance abuse or substance use issue from Science Daily, vaping linked to COVID-19 risk in teens and young adults, study finds. Vaping is linked to a substantial increase of COVID-19 among teenagers and young adults, according to a new study led by researchers at the Stanford University School of Medicine. The study, which will be published online August 11th in the Journal of Adolescent Health, is the first to examine connections between youth vaping and COVID-19 using population-based data collected during the pandemic. Among young people who were tested for the virus that causes COVID-19, the research found that those who vaped were 5 to 7 times more likely to be infected than those who did not use e-cigarettes. Teens and young adults need to know that if you use e-cigarettes, you are likely at immediate risk of COVID-19 because you are damaging your lungs, said the senior author Bonnie Halpern-Felscher, PhD, professor of pediatrics. Young people may believe their age protects them from contracting the virus or that they will not experience symptoms of COVID-19, but the data show this isn't true among those who vape, said the study's lead author, postdoctoral scholar Shivani Mathur Gahi. This study tells us pretty clearly that youth who are using vapes or are dual using e-cigarettes and cigarettes are at elevated risk, and it's not just a small increase in risk, it's a big one. The results were adjusted for confounding factors such as age, sex, LGBTQ status, race, ethnicity, mother's level of education, body mass index, compliance with shelter-in-place orders, rate of COVID-19 diagnosis in the states where the participants were residing, and state and regional trends in e-cigarette use. Among the participants who were tested for COVID-19, those who had ever used e-cigarettes were 5 times more likely to be diagnosed with COVID-19 than non-users. Those who had used both e-cigarettes and conventional cigarettes in the previous 30 days were 7 times more likely to be diagnosed with the disease. The researchers did not find a connection between COVID-19 diagnosis and smoking conventional cigarettes alone, perhaps because the prevalent pattern among youth is to use both vaping devices and traditional cigarettes. Other research has shown that nearly all nicotine-using youth vape, and some also smoke cigarettes, but very few use cigarettes only, Halpern and Felscher said. In addition to warning teenagers and young adults about the dangers of vaping, the researchers hope their findings will prompt the Food and Drug Administration to further tighten regulations governing how vaping products are sold to young people. Now is the time, Halpern and Felscher said. We need the FDA to hurry up and regulate these products. And we need to tell everyone, if you are a vapor, you're putting yourself at risk for COVID-19 and other lung disease. Okay, well, I'd like to take a moment to send out my condolences to all you sports fans out there, as this pandemic, particularly the out-of-control epidemic in this country, is limiting the ability to safely conduct sports. So I'm not a big sports fan, but I feel for y'all who are, because it ain't happening. You're going to have to find some teams perhaps in another country. But I say that as a preface to the next story, which is about studying health effects in NFL players and how there's a widespread inequity that's present by racial ethnic status. So here we go from Science Daily. Black, other non-white athletes report more pain, physical impairment, mood disorders, and cognitive problems than white peers. A career in professional football may yield an array of health benefits that extend beyond playing years. NFL players engage in vigorous training, tend to be more educated than other men in the U.S., and have higher median incomes than most fellow Americans, all factors associated with better overall health. But new research from Harvard Medical School and the Harvard School of Public Health suggests that even these advantages may not be enough to neutralize persistent gaps in health outcomes among black, white, and players of other racial backgrounds. The analysis, based on self-reports among former NFL players, found that black players were significantly more likely than white players to experience diminished quality of life due to impaired physical function, pain, cognitive troubles, depression, and anxiety. In 4 of 5 health outcomes, the gaps were greatest between black and white former players. The findings, published on August 4th in Annals of Epidemiology, are based on a survey of 3,794 former NFL players aged 24 to 89, conducted as part of the ongoing Football Players Health Study at Harvard University, a research initiative that encompasses a constellation of studies designed to evaluate various aspects of players' health across the lifespan. Next, the researchers compared self-reported symptoms in 5 categories: physical functioning, pain, cognitive function, depression, and anxiety. The analysis showed that black former NFL players were 50% more likely than white former players to have pain that interfered with daily activities, as well as depression and anxiety. Black former players were 36% more likely to have cognitive symptoms, including memory deficits and attention problems, that impacted their quality of life. Black former players were also nearly 90% more likely to report impaired physical functioning compared to their white peers. Our analysis points to persistent and dramatic gaps in health outcomes among former NFL players that are particularly pronounced among black athletes and also present among other Hawaiians, Native Americans, and Asian players, said study lead author Andrea Roberts, senior research scientist at the Harvard School of Public Health. Our findings underscore the urgent need to develop public health interventions and policies that address underlying systemic factors that give rise to such disparities, both among former athletes and in the general population, Roberts added. To examine the role of other factors that may affect health outcomes, the researchers also looked at the number of seasons played in the NFL, position played, concussion symptoms, surgeries, body mass index, use of performance-enhancing drugs, lifestyle habits including drinking and smoking, as well as pain medication use. The differences persisted even when the researchers accounted for the possible influence of all or each of these factors. Next, the researchers examined whether differences in health varied by a player's age as a surrogate marker for diversity and equity in the area that they played in. Although younger non-white players were in the NFL during a period marked by greater diversity and greater equity, their risk for adverse health outcomes remained the same as that of older players. The researchers suggest that factors such as discrimination prior to, during, or following a player's time in the NFL could account for the disparities. Systemic and structural racism has been linked with worse mental, physical health, and higher mortality. Additionally, past research indicates that non-whites are more likely to receive lower quality health care than whites. We tend to think that elite athletes may be shielded from health inequities, but our findings counter that notion and reveal important differences in quality of life among former athletes, said study senior author Mark Weisskopf, professor of environmental epidemiology and physiology at the Harvard's School of Public Health. These gaps echo well-documented health disparities in the general population and demand both short-term interventions and long-term solutions. As we begin to unpack the complexities around these health disparities between white and non-white players, we can begin to see the confluence of challenges that extend beyond the socioeconomic benefits of playing in the NFL, said study co-author Herman Taylor, a co-investigator of the Football Players Health Study and director of the Cardiovascular Research Institute at the Morehouse School of Medicine. Meaningful solutions to systemic inequities that fuel health disparities will not emerge overnight. In the meantime, we urge players to consult their physicians about the health concerns we've outlined in the study that might impact their quality of life. Okay, back to some world news. This from Science Daily. Globally, only half of women get treatment for a preventable killer of newborns. Only half of pregnant women worldwide who need a treatment developed over 50 years ago to prevent Rh disease, an often fatal condition in fetuses and newborns that is now exceedingly rare in the United States and Western Europe, actually receive it, finds a study led by researchers at Vagelos College of Physicians and Surgeons at Columbia University Irving Medical Center. A previous study estimated that complications of the disease may be linked to the deaths of at least 50,000 fetuses and 114,000 newborns worldwide annually. These findings are tragically surprising and disappointing, says Stephen Spitalnik, MD, professor of pathology and cell biology, and senior author of the study. This is a global crisis in which hundreds of thousands of fetuses and newborns are at risk for complications and death due to Rh disease because of a lack of awareness about, access to, and availability of effective measures to prevent this disease. Approximately 15% of women in the United States and 70% in Europe lack a protein in their red blood cell called the Rh factor. However, the estimated prevalence of women with the so-called Rh-negative blood type varies widely among different ethnic groups worldwide. When such women become pregnant, red blood cells from an Rh-positive fetus can make their way into the mother's circulation during pregnancy or at delivery. This incompatibility prompts the mother's immune system to make antibodies and become sensitized to the fetus's red blood cells. During following pregnancies, the mother's sensitized immune system is more likely to launch an attack against her fetus, leading to Rh disease. More than half of fetuses or newborns with Rh disease die. Those with severe disease who survive may have significant brain damage. In the 1960s, physicians at Columbia University developed an immunoprophylaxis therapy, Rhd immunoglobulin, that prevents the mother from becoming sensitized to her child's blood cells. Since then, Rh disease almost never occurs in the United States and other high-income countries. This treatment is a standard of care for preventing Rh disease, but we recognize that there remain significant obstacles to expanding access to this life-saving therapy around the world, says Spitalnik, who has been working with an international team of physicians to increase access to the therapy of Rhd immunoglobulin around the world. The study found an annual worldwide gap of more than 2.5 million doses below the minimum recommended threshold for preventing Rh disease. In particular, in 100 countries, fewer than 80% of pregnant women who require the therapy received a dose after delivery. The biggest shortfalls occur in South Asia and Sub-Saharan Africa. Both regions have a high incidence of neonatal deaths due to complications of Rh disease, but virtually no Rhd immunoglobulin was dispensed. The researchers found that none of the regions studied had acceptable levels of adherence to recommended guidelines for preventing Rh disease. A variety of factors, including lack of awareness of Rh incompatibility, limited availability of the therapy, and other healthcare priorities, play a role in hindering access to this life-saving therapy around the world. Now that we have a better understanding of these gaps in treatment, we can begin to address them on a regional level. To this end, the co-authors of the study, along with an international group of collaborators in obstetrics and gynecology, midwifery, pediatrics, neonatology, epidemiology, and transfusion medicine, established Worldwide Initiative Rh Disease Eradication, a nonprofit organization dedicated to improving education about Rh disease and enhancing access to blood type testing and Rhd immunoglobulin. Well, good luck to them. Okay, well, I'm going to end today's show with something that's been a pet peeve of mine for a long time as a nutritionist and consumer. of whole grains is that labeling can be very confusing, particularly on bread. Trying to figure out what's whole wheat bread without reading the actual ingredients is very difficult. And finally, my personal experience with that has been corroborated with scientific data. This from Science Daily. Researchers say results provide legal evidence for proposed changes in labeling regulations. Whole grain labels on cereal, bread, and crackers are confusing to consumers and could cause them to make fewer healthy choices, according to the result of a study that tested whether people are able to pick out the healthier whole grain option based on food package labels. The study, led by researchers at the Gerald and Dorothy Friedman School of Nutrition Science and Policy at Tufts University and the NYU School of Global Public Health, is published in the journal Public Health Nutrition. The researchers say the findings could help lead to enhancements in food labeling. A pool of 1,030 U.S. adults, representative of the population, responded to a survey with photos of both hypothetical and real products. The photos showed the products with various whole grain labels on the front of the package, along with a nutrition facts label and ingredients list for each product. Participants were asked to identify the healthier option for the hypothetical products or assess the whole grain content for the real products. For the hypothetical products, 29-47% of respondents answered incorrectly. Specifically, 31% incorrectly for cereal, 29-37% for crackers, and 47% for bread. For real products that were not mostly composed of whole grains, 43-51% of respondents overstated the whole grain content. Specifically, 41% overstated for multigrain crackers, 43% for honey wheat bread, and 51% for 12-grain bread. Consumers more accurately stated the whole grain content for an oat cereal product that really was mostly composed of whole grain. Our study results show that many consumers cannot correctly identify the amount of whole grains or select a healthier whole grain product. Manufacturers have many ways to persuade you that the product is whole grain, even if it doesn't. They can tell you it's multigrain or they can color it brown, but those signals do not really indicate the whole grain content, said first author Park Wild, a food economist and professor at the Friedman School. The packages on the hypothetical products either had no front-of-package whole grain label or marked with multigrain, made with whole grains, or a whole grain stamp. The packages on the real products displayed the actual product markings, including multigrain, honey wheat, and 12-grain. The study goal was to assess whether consumer misunderstanding of the labels meets a legal standard for enhanced U.S. labeling requirements for whole grain products. The legal standard relates to deceptive advertising, and evidence that the labels are actually misleading or likely to mislead consumers can bolster support for regulations. With the results of this study, we have strong legal argument that whole grain labels are misleading, in fact. I would say that comes to deceptive labels, whole grain claims are among the worst. Even people with advanced degrees cannot figure out how much whole grain is in these products, said co-author Jennifer Pomerantz, assistant professor of public health policy and management at the NYU School of Global Public Health. Previous research has shown disparities in whole grain intake in the United States, including, for example, lower intake for adolescents than for adults, and lower intake for participants in the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP program, than for higher-income non-participants. The authors of the new study found that consumers who were younger had less education, were Black or African-American, or reported having difficulty understanding food labels were more likely to answer incorrectly in the test involving hypothetical products. The 2015 to 2020 Dietary Guidelines for Americans recommends that half of all grains consumed should be whole grains. Adequate intake of whole grains has been linked to reduced resist for heart disease, type 2 diabetes, and cancer. A large chunk of America's daily calories, 42%, comes from low-quality carbohydrates. Consuming more whole grains can help change that, but the policy challenge is to provide consumers with clear labels in order to make those healthier choices, said co-senior author Feng Zhang, nutrition epidemiologist at the Friedman School. Limitations of the study include the fact that higher education respondents were moderately overrepresented, which means the results were in fact conservative. Okay, well, that does it for today's show. If you have any questions or comments, feel free to email me at wakt@toppun.com. If you'd like to re-listen to this show, queue up future shows, or listen to previous shows, you can go to toppun.com/blog/WAKT, or you can search for Just for the Health of It, WAKT, on Facebook and like the page, and you'll get some bonuses of some other public health news stories that you won't actually even hear on the show. So go to Facebook and like the page. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the Donald Trump Memorial Studio, and I'll be ending with a quote from the great Mahatma Gandhi. When I despair, I remember that all through history, the way of truth and love has always won. There have been tyrants and murderers, and for a time they can seem invincible, but in the end, they always fall. Always. And let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. I need some justice.